You don't.
Convening this meeting of the Subcommittee on Human Services, Joint Committee on Ways and Means. Today is Monday, April 20th. We are continuing with a public hearing on House Bill 5026, Department of Human Services, continuing policy option packages in the recommended budget. Ms. Kelly Seal.
Good morning, Co-Chair Nathanson, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Erin Kelly Seal. I'm the Director of the Department of Human Services.
And I'm Jerry Weibrandt, the Chief Operations Officer for Child Welfare and Self-Sufficiency.
And I'm Art Ayer with the Chief Financial Office and DAS.
On Thursday of last week, we took you through the majority of the organization and the recommended investments that were there. And today we're going to focus on self-sufficiency and some packages that fall into the central and shared services arena. And hopefully we will be able to wrap up before the end of time. I'm just going to jump right in. If you recall, the conversations that we have been having with you have been about how the department brought together the recommendations that it did, what it prioritized and why, and some of the challenges that we see without these options moving forward. By far, one of the largest general fund investments that the governor recommended in the budget and that I know Governor Brown also supports is the investment in employment-related daycare. This has been a conversation that the legislature has been having actively in the policy committees. There is a House Bill 2015 that I believe is now already waiting for you all to consider as the conversation about budget moves forward. And that bill actually goes even a little bit further than this policy package because we had some events take place at the federal level after the governor's budget around the Child Care Development Block Grant and its reauthorization. And there are some additional policy statements that are made in House Bill 2015 that I'm sure Representative Kinney-Geyer or others on her committee might want to speak to. But in general, the governor wanted to be sure that as the economy is in recovery, that we are creating opportunities for families to be able to maintain and to get back to work and to maintain employment. And that also in this package, one of the recognitions is that the cost per case in the employment-related daycare program is currently rising. That is good news for our kindergarten readiness agenda as a state. It means that more parents in this program are taking advantage of care that is more costly, that is higher quality. And some of the changes that are on the horizon for the program, given the reauthorization of the Child Care Development Block Grant, are things like continuous eligibility for 12 months, which will also contribute to a child's ability to be in a care setting for a more continuous period of time, and hopefully then contribute to their readiness for kindergarten and their readiness to learn. This package was focused on increasing the caseload. And so in the budget, what you'll see is that it took the average caseload for the employment-related daycare program from 7,800 children to around 10,800 for the biennium.
Does this also include 12-month guaranteed eligibility?
Co-Chair Nathanson, Senator Steiner Hayward, this package did not include that. It is recommended as part of House Bill 2015. There are trade-offs in this program. The cost for eligibility for 12 months is about $9 million general fund. So if this were the package amount that were invested, you would have to offset for that policy change the number of families that were served.
Follow up, if I may, Madam Chair?
Yes.
Thank you. So if we increased this number to 10,800 families and did 12-month eligibility, that would be an additional $9 million on top of the 49.6 that's part of this POP?
Co-Chair Nathanson, Senator Steiner Hayward, if your goal is to get to an average of 10,800 families for the biennium, yes. If you still could increase, with this level of investment, you still could have the 12-month continuous eligibility and increase the caseload just at this level of funding. It would just be less than 10,800, and I'm sorry, I don't know the number off the top of my head.
If you could let us know that, that'd be great. And one very fast follow-up. Do you have a sense... the best of all possible worlds, you get 10,800 or maybe even more and 12-month eligibility. but if you couldn't, what's better, 12-month eligibility or more families with more choppy eligibility?
Representative Nathanson, Senator Steiner-Hayward, in this case, part of the answer is it's now going to be required. And so it's not really an option any longer from a policy perspective. But I do think, you know, this is just my personal opinion. I think what's difficult about this program is there are so many families who need it. And however, I also think that when a family loses temporary employment and then therefore lose their child care, their child loses that continuity, perhaps even their place, and then the parent finds employment again and the child is not able to go back to the provider they were with or has to find a new provider and restart relationship, that discontinuity can be hard on a little person. And so I do think the 12-month continuous eligibility is the right policy, and I'm glad to see us pursuing it.
Thank you.
And Representative Stark.
Thank you, Chair. Aaron, just to help me understand here, because I've, you know, paid a lot of attention to House Bill 2015, and my understanding is it has approximately a $60 million price tag on it. That, compared to this proposal, no one has clarified for me, is that $60 million in addition to what we're looking at here, or is there overlap there? Because part of that proposal is the increased caseload. And so where do those overlap numbers-wise?
Co-Chair Nathanson, Representative Stark. There is overlap, and we actually have prepared a graphic, a matrix, if you will, that we could send to the committee that talks about where the overlap is and isn't between the two proposals. This proposal is fairly simple. It was purely about increasing the caseload. 2015 has additional elements to it and also proposes a caseload increase. We'd be happy to send the matrix over to give you all that detail. That would be helpful.
Thank you.
So, Madam Director, how many other states are doing exactly what we're trying to do right now with this for ERDC?
Co-Chair Nathanson, Representative Olson, could you clarify for me what you mean
by
this?
Okay, so what we're trying to do for the increase with House Bill 2015, are there other states that are mirroring or were mirroring what they're trying to do right now to reach out like that to families?
Co-Chair Nathanson, Representative Olson, I'm happy to do some additional looking. What I will tell you is that especially we often look to our neighbor north of us at their policies and their investments and things that they're doing. They invest far more already in their child care program than Oregon does. So I'm not sure if they have an aggressive schedule to increase their level of investment, but I do know that they already put more into this program, and they have many more parents in Washington who are eligible for their child care subsidy program than we do here in Oregon.
Okay, you don't need to do the homework. I appreciate that. Thanks.
Representative Kenny Geyer.
Okay, thank you. And a quick question. If we got up to 10,800, does that cover roughly 20% of the families that would be eligible for this? Do I have that number correct?
Co-Chair Nathanson, Representative Kenny Geyer, I don't know. I don't know the answer to that.
Okay.
I'm sorry, but I can find out.
Thank you.
Is that what you're doing?
May I ask a clarification just for our staff? So you're looking at the number, Representative Kenny Geyer, of families in Oregon with children who are living at 185% of the federal poverty level and who are working?
Right.
Okay.
And are sending their kids to child care.
Thank you.
Paid child care.
We'll get back to you on the exact percentage. The next investment to review was one that we did spend quite a bit of time on in committee when we did the self-sufficiency overview presentation. It's also a policy conversation that is playing out in the House Human Services Committee today, in fact, with House Bill 3535. And this is with respect to the redesign and reinvestment in the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families program. This is a conversation that really has two major parts to it. As you all know, the TANF caseload is projected, has been declining and is projected to continue to decline in the next biennium. And this investment of $30 million was made possible by the caseload savings that are achieved through that decline. There are additional TANF caseload savings also in the budget, but this is recommending that $30 million of those savings be reinvested directly back into the program. Just for perspective, at the beginning of the Great Recession, after the TANF program had been redesigned in 2008, and we lost the capacity that we lost about $80 million in the TANF budget, particularly around the jobs program. And so $30 million next to that $80 million is what we're recommending be able to come back. You also are well aware that there was an audit of the TANF program and its efficacy in 2014. We have done a side-by-side comparison of what's in the TANF reinvestment proposal and the policy proposals that are in House Bill 3535. And we have made every effort in this conversation to address all of the recommendations that came forward in the audit around how to improve the performance of the program, how to create a program that allows us to better serve the individuals that are receiving services, hopefully stabilizing more families and moving them from crisis into employment. One of the biggest pieces of this reinvestment conversation is really about the benefits cliff. This is about the back end of the TANF program and how quickly people lose eligibility once they're working about 17 hours at minimum wage levels. And the proposal here is to actually carry out their eligibility with a reduced benefit as their number of hours of employment increases, so that we can create a more stable path for them and hopefully allow them to have more stable employment as they transition off of the TANF program. I also wanted to say that we are really well aware of the need to pour intensive service and create synergy with our community partners around some intensity of service for families that are nearing the end of their TANF lifetime limit, which also we see coming in the next biennium, which is another reason for this reinvestment recommendation. And what we also know to be true is that these families require to be successful, they need more than just the Department of Human Services, and there's a lot of opportunity that this reinvestment represents for us to be able to better partner at the community level on behalf of our clients. This slide probably looks familiar. This outlines for you where the investments are targeted in terms of that $30 million. You can see that we have, starting from left to right in the purple, a conversation that we want to have about our ability to prevent TANF entry for families, our ability to help families who maybe are just one house payment away from total instability and crisis, to be able to stabilize them and hopefully keep them off of the program as a safety net and keep them stable in their homes or their employment, whatever that might look like for them. There are some best practice models. This isn't a lot of money, and so we're hoping to be able to do some evaluation of some models in targeted ways to demonstrate the connection between job retention, family stability, and this front-end prevention service that we'd like to restart. We don't currently have this in the program, and we have historically in the TANF program provided services like this. We also currently don't invest much in this program around the issue of family stability and children. Remember, you have to have a child to be eligible for the TANF program. The major investments currently in the program are in the cash assistance payments, which families use to stabilize their households, pay rent, pay bills, et cetera, and also then in the jobs program, which is really about getting people the skills and the training and back on their feet so that they can find work. This would increase our capacity to help families and provide a little bit of a bridge. If you remember the last look that we took at our children in foster care, within the last 2 months, about a third of those children had been in the TANF program. So for many reasons, this is a prevention investment that can help us, we hope, maintain child stability, child safety, while we're also working with parents on their own ability to be work ready. We have a piece here, I skipped over the one of the chevrons, which is really about streamlining the eligibility There is a policy in Oregon's TANF program around parental deprivation, which is very antiquated and outdated, and this package would help us to eliminate that policy. It's something that came up in our focus groups with clients as something that seemed contrary to them, to what we were trying to help them to achieve in terms of family connectedness and stability, even if they were a single-parent household with a parent that they were that was trying to co-parent but was no longer residing in the home. And then finally, this last piece, the green chevron, is really about the benefits cliff and investments in trying to help families be able to move into higher income and higher wage levels before they lose eligibility for the program. At the bottom, you see a large investment in some capacity, and that's partly in us and our staff and our case management capacity. If you recall, last session we repurposed about 160 eligibility staff into new case management positions. A large part of the TANF audit was really about the department's capacity to work with clients directly, to have that time with clients in order to be able to have case plans developed, ongoing monitoring of client contact and client investment in services. And this reinvestment in the DHS staff is partly to do that and also to be sure we can have the level of intense focus and lower caseloads that we need to serve those families with the highest needs who are going to be nearing their lifetime limit for the program. This bucket also includes some program evaluation, which in talking with the national experts and our community of partners is highly important with respect to our ability to understand what happens when people leave the program. It's also an investment in performance-based contracting. This program has been moving toward more performance-based contracts over time, and our provider community is telling us they're fully supportive of that. They, however, would like some additional help and support in order to really make that shift. And we know that internally we need to be able to manage our contracts and our contract administration process differently in order to be able to hold people accountable differently to outcomes instead of output. So there's a lot in that bottom bucket, and we do have a two-pager that outlines it in much more detail that we'd be happy to get to the committee if that would be helpful. But I have been anticipating that there will be a hearing on that piece of legislation, and you'll have more time at that point to discuss some of the detail.
Before we move away from it, I would like a brief response on a couple of points. In the bottom bucket, as you describe it, how much is budgeted for evaluation? And is that evaluation, are we budgeting for people in-house, or are we contracting for some sort of consultant or consulting firm to do evaluation? So how much would be spent on evaluation? What proportion of that $11.6 million is it? And on case management, we would move from what to what, like managing 4 to 2 or 40 to 30? How does it reduce the number of cases per caseworker?
Co-Chair Nathanson, I believe the amount invested in the evaluation is about $500,000, and the intent was to look outside the organization for that assistance. Do you have the number off the top of your head?
I do not.
Have a piece of paper. Sorry, just consulting with Jerry to see if he remembered. If you give me 1 second, I may have the information with me on the case management level. It's been something we've been talking about quite a bit. Okay. Co-Chair Nathanson, in terms of the workload model, just for perspective, in federal fiscal year 2007, the average caseload per case manager was about 75.5. Is this families or individuals?
It would be families.
Families. In federal fiscal year 2011, when we had the same number of case managers, which was 237, and the caseload had increased so dramatically, the average caseload was 125 families per case manager.
So at any given time, it's not throughout a year you might see that many families. You're saying at any one given time, someone would have that many families on their list in a stack of files on their desk.
Co-Chair Nathanson, yes. And in 2014, the average we now have 400 case managers. The average caseload is about 91 families per case manager.
Okay, a couple other questions. Before you were talking about that, when we were on the row of chevrons. I think it was in the second one you mentioned that there's a policy that should be that's being contemplated for change. Policy meaning agency rules, just an agency culture, or a statute that needs to be changed?
Co-Chair Nathanson, it's a statutory change.
Okay. And in materials that you're sending us, are you telling us specifically what that is? Is it a bill, the subject of a current bill, or a work group for discussion?
Co-Chair Nathanson, it will be in House Bill 3535.
Okay. And backing up to the slide just before that, while we're still on TANF, the third bullet, the benefits cliff identified by national experts as one of the steepest in the country. Families lose benefits when working only 16 hours a week, or I think you might have said 17, and that's at minimum wage. When we talk about benefits cliff, we're often talking about a number of different resources or benefits that people get, not only through DHS. So is this referring to only TANF, or is it referring to the package of potential benefits that someone might qualify for?
Co-Chair Nathanson, this is referring just to TANF. There is an evaluation underway right now that your legislative fiscal staff, your legislative revenue staff, staff from the executive branch are undertaking, and I think it's nearing the end of development that looks at several different benefits, their interplay, including tax credits, public assistance through DHS, and also housing assistance, and then looks at wage and average family and attempts to describe in a different way for you where the cliffs are for families and in which benefits particularly. This comparison was just to TANF programs, specifically looking at how quickly people lose TANF assistance in Oregon as compared to other states.
And I'm particularly struck by the comment, identified by national experts as one of the steepest in the country. How different are we than other states?
Co-Chair Nathanson, I'd love to send you, there's a graph that that this particular expert put together and had a long conversation with the policy committee about. And in other states, what you can see is the benefits taper off more gradually, not always, but most of the time. And what the graph shows is that in Oregon, when you hit the $616 per month as an income level, you lose all benefits very directly and much sooner than in other states. So we'd be happy to send that information over.
Thank you. Representative Stark.
Thank you, Chair. Just to kind of highlight on that, you know, House Bill 3535 is attempting to deal with this specific cliff and phase it off quite a bit better. If I recall right, there's only two or three states that have a steeper cliff specific to TANF than we do. I know we're at least in the top or the worst five on that. But to give you an example, I've done my own chart on this, if someone makes $500 a month, then their TANF benefits are $256 a month. Okay, so if their income is $500 a month, they receive $256. They hit $600 a month, their benefits go to zero. And so it's this huge drop-off, you know, I mean, and if you're looking at that as part of their income, that's a third of their income, and so we incentivize them not working more because they work just a little bit more and they lose a third of their income. And so it's quite an issue, and so that's why in House Bill 3535 and the TANF reinvestment proposal, we're saying let's taper that off, you know, quite a bit more so that you can actually get someone up to $1,000 a month or so and have that income gradually taper down so it's not this harsh thing and they're incentivized to continue working. Just my two cents on it.
Thank you, Senator Bates.
Thank you. Sorry, I was late this morning. I'm going to have to leave at 9:30 again. We have a little problem over the Senate with some bills dying, and I've been called in to
resuscitate them.
To resuscitate the senators involved. Not to be, okay. And I'll be leaving at 9:30 to go do some of that. I have one question and a comment. I'd like to have it answer my comment too. The first question is: I think you said that with the program capacity, that we drop the caseloads to about 90 families per case, per case manager. Is that true?
Co-Chair Bates, yes.
Okay. The question about that, answer when you get a chance, is when I've talked to case managers, and I think of trying to manage 90 families and give them self-sufficiency. I don't know how you do that with 90 families. I could probably do it with one. But, 90 is still a huge number. We basically have been using our case managers in the last 7 or 8 years to get people qualified, and get them help, keep them off the street, give them a place to live, and stabilize them. But the world's changing again, we hope, and we're coming out of this recession. So I don't know how they manage that with a caseload of 90. So that's one question. The second question is, we've got coming to us a whole bunch of things that I think are moving the right direction. Looking how we handle TANF, what we do with the RDC, what we do with minimum wage, what we do with education potentials for people. Back to community colleges for a year or two and get a real education, get a real job afterwards. Those kind of things need to be brought together. I think we have an opportunity in this session to really redesign our self-sufficiency program so they mesh together and start working properly. Those programs will have to be changed a bit to do that, but we have to have caseloads that are low enough for our case managers, once they learn the changes, can actually make a difference. So I'm really worried about what's going on at the level of down the trenches, where these people are really contacting the system and really have an idea of what's available to them and really get them into self-sufficiency. I'm afraid that bits and pieces aren't coming together right now. We need to put those together in a way that really works. So first, your comment about what is a case though that's manageable and actually works. And secondly, how you feel about looking at the entire system in lieu of all this stuff coming in and trying to put together in a way that actually starts to make sense.
Co-Chair Bates, members of the committee, let me start with your second question. I absolutely think that's where we have to be. I think one of the good news points I would tell you is that our teams on the front lines who are integrating into the workforce redesign, the early learning redesign, the coordinated care organizations are reporting back to us voluntarily that they feel like there's more alignment and more synergy at the local level around these families than there's ever been. There's, I think, clarity of purpose around education outcomes, employment outcomes, health outcomes in new ways that feels really good to people, and I think is creating a more efficient experience for families. We've heard the stories of families who have so many people working with them and so many case plans that they're not able. It's actually more than 2 full-time jobs sometimes for these families to even accomplish all the things that the systems are asking them to do. I think we're starting to see that be undone, and I think the systems are working better together. I'd like to have Jerry comment on the issue of the case management level, because he's been much closer to our efforts to redesign our case management program and self-sufficiency around a trauma-informed engagement process for our clients. And I think we're certainly really attentive to the fact that the clients that are particularly those who are nearing the end of their lifetime limit are going to require a much more intense level of service than even the families that we've been already making the extra efforts around.
So, co-chairs Bates and Nathanson, I'm Jerry Wayrand, the Chief Operations Officer for Child Welfare and Self-Sufficiency. Senator Bates, excellent question. Can I start off by saying that the addition of 162 case managers at the beginning of this biennium has helped tremendously? And we talked at our initial Ways and Means presentation about some of the numbers that those folks are delivering working effectively with our families. Last month, we once again exceeded 1,000 job placements across the program. And that stretches back, I think, 13 to the last 14 months that we've exceeded 1,000 folks finding employment as a result of these efforts. Our participation rate is now above 70%. You might remember that we had some concerns about that in terms of some TANF penalties connected to that. And the overall numbers have dropped now down to about 28,700 families on TANF versus about 37,000 families, as we are more effectively able to work with those folks. What we did when we added those 162 new case managers is we added a series of 101, 202, and 303 trainings we provided to them around case management basics, and then enhanced case management with the idea idea that engagement and your ability to work through that trauma-informed practice would enhance our ability to work effectively with families. And while 90 is a large number, it is much less than what we were facing just 4 years ago. And actually, case managers will tell you in general, feels doable compared to what they were. We, of course, would love to see that number at 75 or less, but we believe we can continue to work effectively at that 90 persons caseload. Now, that said, Director Kelly Seale did point out that we're underway with discussions about what we're going to do with those families that are reaching or looking at that benefits clear, or the 60-month cutoff. And we're talking about how we need to specialize a caseload and drop the numbers for those folks in order to work more effectively and intensely with those families to be effective.
And Senator Bates, the last thing I would add is I want to commend our staff on the front line also for continuing their efforts around lean and continuous improvement. We've had some great ideas that people have been piloting and have actually implemented around TANF eligibility, around who's responsible for TANF eligibility, that's also clearing out the paperwork time and allowing for more of a focus on people. And I just want to make sure you hear from us that we continue to strive and work on those efforts as well.
Senator.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It occurs to me to wonder, Ms. Kelly Seale, have some of the changes that you've made in terms of reducing the caseload per worker, bringing more people in, and also reducing the paperwork and things, helped improve staff morale and decrease turnover? Do you have any sense of that? I mean, I know that's been a challenge sometimes because the work that we've asked people to do has been tough and led to a certain amount of burnout. And I'm wondering if we're helping, because obviously experienced staff can be even more effective.
So Senator Bates, or excuse me, Chairs Bates and Nathanson and Senator Steiner Hayward, yes. In fact, I was just looking at some numbers connected to leave time and unfunded leave and some OFLA FEMLA and saw a remarkable decrease on the self-sufficiency side over the last 9 months. I think those additional staff really have helped folks see the tunnel at the end, the end of the Great Recession in a way that we can work effectively with families. We do a series of surveys of our staff through our quarterly business reviews, and the amount of folks reporting that they are positive connected to those is actually extraordinarily high for the agency. So I believe that we are seeing that outcome in terms of the staff morale issue.
Great. Thank you very much.
Ms. Byerly.
Madam Co-Chair, members of the subcommittee, I just wanted to put one thing on the record. Part of this investment in program capacity is due to a loss of other funds, revenue in the agency. So this $11.6 million does include a component that actually lets the agency maintain the current capacity. It's not an investment in new resource, but it's actually allowing the agency to preserve the caseworkers it already has in place. I just wanted to be clear that that's part of what's going on here. It's not just a enhancement. It's really a funding that will allow them to do what they're continue to do what they're doing at the current level.
Thank you. Thank you for explaining that and making sure that that comes out in the public record. I would like this information on this slide then provided to us separately in a different way, so we see very clearly how much is the keep it even part and how much is the enhancement.
Madam Co-Chair,
can you do that for us?
We already have that information. I can provide that to you.
Thank you.
Okay. Food programs, another part of the our self-sufficiency efforts is around our SNAP program, as you know, which is a federal program. And they're at the moment in state government, I'm sure I will misstate this, but at least there are four agencies who have involvement in the issues and in the programs surrounding support for the issue of hunger. The Department of Education for the school nutrition programs, the Department of Agriculture, the Department of Human Services with our SNAP program, and Oregon Housing and Community Services has been the home for the next several programs that we're going to talk about. And the proposal in front of you in the budget is a budget-neutral proposal around a transition of those food programs to the from the Oregon Housing and Community Services Department to the Department of Human Services. This conversation actually started as part of the Oregon Housing Community Services redesign effort that Director Margaret Van Vliet was leading and was a recommendation that came out of that process. Again, it's budget neutral, but it is significant for the programs at the Oregon Food Bank that are impacted by this move, and we have been working with the food bank, with the housing department, and with our director of our SNAP program, Malik Burt, to be sure that we can make a smooth transition, that we don't increase any bureaucracy or administrative overhead by virtue of this transition. What we're really doing is creating the opportunity that's identified here around enhancing leverage and providing new connections to larger food programs in a way that will actually benefit Oregonians as this transfer occurs. So there are two packages that are associated with this move. This package in front of you, POP 301, is with respect to the Commodity Supplemental Food Program. You can see a description of what that program does here. And then there also is the Temporary Emergency Food Assistance Program, both of which are important for different reasons and serve vulnerable populations. A little bit more information in terms of counties served, et cetera. But ultimately, I'd like to also just kind of review for you the next policy package, just so you can see the whole thing together. These are federally funded programs that we would now be responsible for monitoring in terms of their administration. And then this next program, this next policy package is two here. One is an increase of investment by the state around the Oregon Hunger Response Fund. I'm trying to be really careful around these acronyms. I apologize because in my brain I refer to them that way, and so I'm really trying for the sake of the committee and the record to not say the acronym. So apologies while I slow down and read the slide. So first there's the proposal to move the Oregon Hunger Response Fund to the Department of Human Services, and the second is to actually increase it. In talking with our partners at the food bank, I think it's really important to make note both for this program and also for the programs described in the previous policy package that the pressures on food programs continue to be high, even post-recession, as they look at their caseloads. As you know, our TANF caseload is going down significantly. The SNAP caseload is declining, but not as quickly at all. And what I'm hearing from our food bank partners who are in the room, if you'd like to talk with them about this as well, is that their caseloads are not declining. People continue to need to rely on these food programs to supplement their monthly incomes and their ability to feed their families. You can see here some statistics about how many Oregonians use those emergency food boxes and why they continue to be critical. I also want to make a note about the cost of food and the cost of transportation. This really was a large reason for the increase that the governor was recommending in the budget, just the knowledge that the ability for the Oregon Food Bank to move food around and the ability to acquire healthy food is becoming more challenging. At the same time, the need is not declining. So these, again, are important programs. We look forward to the opportunity to continue the partnerships that we already have with the food bank. I would just note that the food bank has been an incredible partner for us around the Temporary Assistance for Needy Family program and our maintenance of effort requirement there. Thanks to their willingness to partner with us around a lot of documentation and infrastructure reporting, we have been able to yield additional federal funds and more easily meet our maintenance of effort requirement in the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families program. So even if the programs don't move, I feel like we have really strong partnerships with the food bank and with these programs and with housing. But the recommendation is to move them, to centralize their administration, and to continue to leverage the partnership.
I'd like to ask you a question on the previous slide, slide 6. The first point mentions an opportunity to receive food and nutrition education. The reason I ask is I had a visit in my office last week from some representatives from the local food bank in my community, and I was extremely impressed with some of the information they provided, including a few short little comments handwritten by clients who had been using the services of the one or the other food pantries that was in the community. And on these handwritten notes, there are several messages about appreciating learning how to shop for nutritious food based on what's available and what's on sale at the grocery store, receiving coaching and assistance in that one time to be a better shopper, to buy better, more nutritious food, and then cooking, how to prepare it. And a couple of those had very heartwarming and important stories that carry over to the healthcare realm, talking about how they had lost weight, blood pressure was lower, there were really good health outcomes, but from educational programs that were being delivered through the food bank. Now, this bullet point refers to seniors age 60 and older. The messages that were written to me were by younger persons. So is there more than one program available that we can receive matching funds for or some other sort of assistance with? Or is this something that my local food bank is doing just because it knows it's the right thing to do?
Co-Chair Nathanson, I'd like to ask two people to come up, a representative from the food bank, and also Belit Burke, who is our SNAP administrator. The issue of nutrition, I'm so glad you brought it up, is a major focus for the organization right now around these programs and services. And they could talk both about what's going on that is through the nutrition program and the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. But first, I'll have John answer your question about the food bank and their efforts that are, I think, population-wide around nutrition.
Co-chairs, members of the subcommittee, good morning. My name is John Steubenvall. I'm the Director of Advocacy at Oregon Food Bank. Madam Co-Chair, to respond to your question, the Oregon Food Bank network comprised of 20 regional food banks throughout the state, and Food for Lane County, I believe, is the local food bank with whom you visited last week. Many of our regional food banks currently partner with the Department of Human Services and other community partners, Oregon State University Extension Service, for example, in providing educational programming to food bank clients. We look forward to additional partnership opportunities with the department as the transition of program takes place. Historically, there also have been food bank efforts that have been really private sector charitable efforts only. So we have also provided some nutritional programming really on our own in years past. But going forward, we look forward to working more closely with the department and with other community partners in this type of activity.
Thank you.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Philippe Burke. I'm the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program Manager. Chair Nathanson, members of the committee. The Commodity Supplemental Food Program is a very small program. We are one of the states that have one of the smaller caseloads in the nation. And it serves, it provides food boxes to seniors in Multnomah County, Lane County, and where's the last one?
Pendleton.
Thank you, Pendleton, and Gilliam, and Jackson counties. And so with those programs, currently the Housing and Community Services provides a newsletter that has some nutrition information. We're looking forward to the opportunity to partner better with our nutrition education program, which we currently partner with the food banks. And what we have done in this state is we've expanded our state plan to increase these partnerships so that we can do better coverage and provide that nutrition education more broadly with the different partnerships.
Thank you. Yes, Representative.
A couple things. Thank you. One is just a comment about the Hunger Relief Task Force. That's one of the pieces that I believe, is going over to DHS but doesn't have identified funding yet. Is that correct?
Co-chairs, Representative Kenny Geyer, yes. In the statutory proposal, it does move the Hunger Task Force to the department, and it does not currently address the issue of their funding.
Okay, so I know that is a question for us. The other question was increased costs in transportation. The gas at least has gone down, so I don't know if that's a lag in the data that's collected or whether it's because you're doing more, sending products out farther outreach, rural. Are you doing more cross-sector? I'm just curious about why transportation costs would go up.
Co-chairs, Representative Kennedy Geyer, part of what you're seeing in this increased cost is really a shift in emphasis with the Oregon Food Bank Network. For example, one of our key initiatives is an emphasis on fresh food, especially fresh produce, which frankly costs more to acquire and move. We need Oregon Food Bank and locations throughout the state need refrigerated trucking, need refrigerated storage. We need our partners to have those kind of capabilities as well. So while some costs, fuel, for example, has declined slightly, other costs are on the increase because our emphasis is more nutritional product that is going to, frankly, better support Oregon agriculture as well.
Great. Thank you so much.
Thank you all.
All right, continuing, another partnership program that the Department of Human Services is fortunate to be part of and be having a conversation with you about relative to budget is 211 Info. I know this came up in our phase one hearings as well. It's recommended in the budget that there be a general fund increase investment to this program. It's my basic understanding, looking at the report that DAS provided in response to a budget note that was asked of by the Ways and Means Committees during the last biennium, that in the 13-15 biennium, approximately $400,000 of general fund was appropriated to 211 Info. This would increase that amount by $600,000. And in talking with representatives from 211 Info, who also are here because they're expert in their own programs, this would accomplish a couple of things in terms of improved quality of service, things like increasing staff to reduce response time for callers, the ability to update their databases more frequently statewide, and then also the ability to deepen their relationships and outreach with frequently referred to programs. Something Representative Nathanson had brought up in a prior hearing was the need for state agencies to better utilize the real-time data available from 211, and this policy package also would allow that for that and allow for a more, I think, efficient and streamlined process for sharing that data and information. I just would note that I know that 211 Info is actively discussing an assessment and a higher level of increase in terms of investment in them and in their resources, and also would note that multiple state agencies have contracts with 211 Info as well for purchase around specific service to specific populations. So I just wanted to put that comprehensive look out there. With that, I see there already are questions.
Mm-hmm. Senator Steiner-Haber.
Thank you. Actually, Madam Chair and Ms. Kelly, so it's actually just a brief addition to what you just said. I co-chair the General Government Subcommittee that Representative Nathanson also sits on, much to my pleasure. And we are talking about potentially including a broader assessment, multi-agency assessment to help fund 211. Because they are taking on a larger and larger role from multiple agencies. For example, they have a contract with State Parks to fund the Tsunami Debris Hotline. They may well be picking up something for the Department of Agriculture around pesticide spraying. So they're starting to play a role in multiple different, providing a single point of entry, as it were, for multiple different kinds of information that Oregonians may seek across the state. They now have presence in every single county in the state, are actively partnering with a range of service organizations in each county, and it's becoming more and more quasi state agency in the sense that they are facilitating access to a range of programs. And so, for example, people in need of emergency rent assistance don't have to call around to multiple DHCS partners that may have funding for that, but instead call 211, who's kept constantly updated about who still has money left in any given month. So I think it's a really important service for a whole range of information and coordination that Oregonians need, and I'm excited about this prospect. Thank you for bringing up that issue, Ms. Kelly Seale.
Thank you, Chair. I'm hoping it might be someone up here who clarifies this for me. I have prefaced with, it's not that I have an issue with 211. I'm trying to understand the logic of this. So remember, I'm coming from an area where 211 is yet to really infiltrate, you know, Southern Oregon a whole lot. I had never heard of it until I was up here in my state office and someone came in to tell me about it. And so I'm trying to understand the logic of, we pay millions of dollars to, or we provide millions of dollars to agencies and part of that budget usually includes promotion and so forth and PR work, and then they pay that out to 211 to promote for them, and then 211 tells them somebody else how to call that agency, and so now we're just skipping. I'm trying to understand, if we're spending money, giving agencies money to promote themselves, and now we're going to give 211 money to promote agencies, does that mean we're giving less money to the agencies for that promotion area? If that's being delegated out to 211, is there a plan for it to truly go statewide? Because we're all paying into these services and fees, and there's much of the state that really has little connection with 211. I know that's kind of a confusion, but I'm just trying to understand the overall, you said quasi-governmental agency, this relationship is blurred to me. So,
Ms. Kelly Seale, do you want to try to respond or have someone from representing 211 to...
Co-chairs, I'd love to represent someone from 211 to come up and help me, especially around the issue of statewideness and the level of effort that they're making in some of the more rural communities to be better known. I think what I would comment on from a state agency perspective is that I think that we are still learning about our partnership and how best to leverage and use it. I just would remind the committee that during the recession era budgets, state agencies were depleted almost entirely of any promotional budgets or any advertising budgets. And I know we've done multiple reports for the legislature about how much or little there is that is there in terms of advocacy for state agencies. I have really seen 211 work effectively in a different way, which is that, I think we all appreciate it at the state agency level that, one, we aren't the only entities that are interfacing with Oregonians. And very frequently, Oregonians don't identify with a particular agency or program. They identify with a need. And what 211 does is it streamlines the process for individual Oregonians to know one number to call and say, this is my need. And they don't have to have hit the right agency. They don't have to hit the right program. And I've sat in the 211 call center before, and I'll tell you, most frequently, the referrals that are being made for the individual Oregonians are not to state agencies. They're actually being made to the community provider networks that are there, and they help to, I think, make a better customer. They create a better customer service because they can target. I mean, as Senator Steiner Hayward mentioned, they often have information that agencies don't have about who still has beds or who still has resources in the community because they keep up to date with that kind of information. State agencies used to keep, and I think I have an old copy of one, directories that were very, very, very thick of the community resources, and it was very hard to keep them current. So often we were sending people to the wrong place at the wrong time for the wrong thing. So it's been, I think we're still learning about our relationship and how we leverage it, but I think it's making things more efficient and it's making things better for people. That's my perspective on it. But.
Co-Chair Bates and Nathanson, members of the committee, good morning. I'm Dan Herman. I'm the CEO of 211 Info, and we're an information referral service around the state of Oregon for Health and Human Services. Welcome your questions. It's been a tremendous strategic partnership to date, I would term it, and we're looking for additional ways to take a solid relationship and really strengthen that. And Aaron hit a number of, I think, what are fundamental benefits of why 211, but we're glad to talk more to that.
Okay. And Senator Bates. Co-Chair Bates and Nathanson. My name is Michael Fieldman. I'm the chair of the board for 211, but I'm also the executive director of the United Community Action Network, or UCAN, which is a community action agency that serves Douglas and Josephine County. So we have offices in Grants Pass and in Roseburg. And so if I'd be more than glad to respond to Representative Stark's comments, too, about that area, if you'd like.
Yes, please.
You want me to go? Yeah. I was interested to hear your comments because actually I think it indicates where we are at in the rural areas with 211. I've actually been working trying to bring 211 to the rural areas probably for about 14 years since I pretty much moved to the state. I think it was when I had my first meeting in Douglas County for 211 because I really saw the importance of this service as a really sort of backbone service for the community. We're still trying to get the message out to the rural communities, but I think we've done a really good job. I think we've had, last year we had somewhere around 2,000, 3,000 in Josephine County requests for information from 211. So the word is getting out, but we need to do a better job with it. And that's part of what this investment is going to allow us to do, is to be able to start really moving it out, the word, getting the word out more into the rural communities. I think it's also going to act as a sort of a leverage point for some of the foundations. We have a request into the Ford Family Foundation for funding to help fund some positions in the rural areas to really build the brand of 211 in the rural communities and strengthen the databases we have. And I think they're waiting to see what kind of investment the state is willing to make in it before they move forward, too. So I think it really has a potential leverage point for that, too. I just wanted to sort of echo what was said already, that 211 really is that one point of entrance that people can have to find information. When they call because they're interested and they need help with their utility bills or with housing, and they don't know what agency to go to, and so that's how they how they're able to access that information. And for the most part in Josephine County, the main referrals are to the ROC and then also UCAN. Those are the main ones. So, and the ROC is a food bank in our community. So
Co-Chair Bates and Nathanson, members of the committee, Representative Stark, to your question. I think another salient benefit here is the fact that when a client makes contact with 211 Info, we take the time to ask a second question, and there's really an exploratory period that goes on, of which this investment would help expand that time to do that. There's an exploratory second question that goes on that oftentimes surfaces a core need, a root cause, and additional issues that need to be addressed. And if you do that at the agency level, oftentimes you'll get a more siloed approach in terms of the information exchange. And so here you get a broader, more systemic look at things. And then secondly, I would say to that, it really allows the state agencies to focus on their core mission and where their greatest value can be attributed to the system and the work they do, and allows what is our contact center, resource database, data analytics to really focus on what are our key engines and our successes to date.
Thank you. I'm going to take the liberty of putting out something that I think about Representative Stark's question as well. And this is entirely anecdotal, and maybe you folks can tell me whether I'm right or wrong. I've had conversations with community agencies that receive funding from, for example, from DHCS, Department of Housing and Community Services, to provide emergency rent assistance or help with rehousing people, and with food banks and everything, where they say, the nice thing about 211 is that we spend less time answering the phone and more time providing direct service. Because when we do answer the phone, when someone's calling after a referral from 211, we know we're the right person for them to call. And we don't have to take the time to figure out where they really should be calling if we're not the right one, and we don't have to tell them, sorry, we've run out of money. We can really spend the time providing the direct program rather than being phone people. So I think that there's a leveraging of state funds in a different way by supporting an organization like 211. I agree, we should not be duplicating things. That being said, you know, the point Ms. Kelly Seal made earlier about reassigning self-sufficiency workers to do more direct casework and less eligibility testing. Again, that's one of the things that 211 can help with. You mean that folks at DHS are spending more time really helping people get back on their feet and get to true self-sufficiency and less time triaging. I think that's a way to leverage state funds too, and you don't have to cross-train people. You know, people aren't sort of siloed out among lots of different programs. They're aware of and have access to a wide range of programs across a wide range of both community and government agencies. So that's been my understanding. I spent a half day at the 211 Center, and if anybody's curious, I'd encourage you to do it because it's a really cool experience. Yeah. It's one of the reasons I'm a staunch advocate, I will freely admit. But
and Co-Chair Nathanson and members of the committee, I would simply add, if the goals are efficiency and effectiveness of the system, I think to Senator Steinert Hayward's points, I think that's exactly true. I think it's a movement in that direction by further utilization of 211 info.
Thank you. We have several other topics to complete in the next 25 minutes. It looks like we have a final comment or question on this one.
Thank you, Chair. I'm encouraged to hear that there is efficient ways of doing this. At the same time, I'm mutually discouraged with the idea of and the response of the siloed effect of if someone actually calls the agency themselves. I had a constituent calling me in the last week about they went in for or made a phone call for one service, and there was a whole handful of things all across the board that were related to DHS that would have really helped this individual. And each thing she had to seek out individually without, you know, the first phone call connecting. And I feel like for the resources that we put into the DHS, that we should be able to pull off that excellency in that manner as well when people call in, and that we shouldn't have to go outside to get someone. I'm pleased that you guys are stepping in, and we might be able to shift some resources and have you guys do that. But I would, and I understand caseworkers are overworked, but I'm discouraged about the silo effect when people call in. So there's my statement.
I will be interested to follow the fate of the bill that has made its way through the House now to ask the agency to start looking at consolidating eligibility intake, which should raise some questions and I hope offer some solutions to that.
Representative Nathan, we also have some information on the utilization or by county of the 211 services. We'll leave with you.
Thank you very much. We will look forward to receiving those.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you.
Co-chairs, I just want to comment briefly on Representative Stark's point. I wholeheartedly agree that we have got to continually make efforts to educate our frontline staff so that people have the experience that is welcoming and inclusive and holistic when they encounter our organization. I think there are a couple of things that we're trying to do in that respect. We are working on legislation with Senator Steiner Hayward around a universal client consent form so that we, if clients consent to us with programs they're volunteering for, to our ability to share information more readily among ourselves, we can do that. And we also have much more cross-training that is just now restarting throughout the department. That is something that we're really paying attention to and really trying to make sure that our front door, front reception folks have awareness about. We're a big agency, and often the needs of individuals transcend our organization, too. You heard a lot about housing and community partnerships. And so back to these investments, I think it's just another way for us to be holistic in terms of an organization about consumers from the consumer perspective as opposed to the program perspective, which we're really working on and trying to get better at every day. The next policy package is focusing on an issue I know that is near and dear to Representative Olson's heart. He has spent a lot of time also with former State Representative Carolyn Tomei and the agency working on the issue of fraud and program integrity. As a direct result of that, there are several bills moving through the legislative session that I know Representative Olson looks for your support on. In addition, I call your attention to this next policy package, which was another part of the discussion we also had during the overview presentation about the need for more individuals in our investigative units to be able to respond to the increasing number of calls regarding the possibility of fraud. This policy package does invest in new investigative staff, and it basically catches this unit up to the caseload growth that has occurred, both in the program, but also, quite frankly, in the number of concerns and calls that we receive that we absolutely want to be responsive to when Oregonians make inquiries of us. As you can see here right now, there are high average caseloads per fraud investigator. And what this investment will do will allow us to, I think, be better partners in terms of our partnerships with our local law enforcement. It will help us to reduce the length of time of investigations, which, quite frankly, will be good for taxpayers and good for clients. These are, you know, it does happen that investigations occur and are not substantiated, and when someone is in the middle of one of those, it's a very stressful process for them. And when, however, an investigation is substantiated, we want to be able to move quickly into the overpayment and recovery process, and this will also allow us to do that more quickly. The last piece I haven't mentioned yet is that we have been working hard on using data differently and better. And there is an issue for us around our ability to move our investigative units around more efficiently. So both in terms of data mining and statewide placement of investigators and reduced costs for travel, that's something else that right-sizing this unit will help us accomplish through this policy package. The next policy package is something that also relates to a work group that the legislature sponsored, Senate Bill 450, Senator Steiner Hayward's direct involvement in that, with respect to our ability to use and analyze data across agencies. This policy package actually will benefit multiple agencies, not just the Department of Human Services. And I know the co-chairs received a letter that was co-signed by Fair Bors, the director of the Oregon Youth Authority, Colette, the director of the Department of Corrections, and also Rob Saxon, the director of the Department of Education. All of our departments have been working together around efforts to use the data that we have at that population level differently so that we can get you better information about which to base your policy, upon which to make to base your policy decisions. We at the Department of Human Services and the Oregon Health Authority happen to already be the home of what is called an integrated client services database. And so this proposal actually takes a look at what is going on in Washington State, where they're pretty well known for their ability to analyze data across populations and across programs and across agencies. And they publish regular reports. They do regular, they receive inquiries from their legislative body that they regularly analyze for them. And they look at things like cost, risk, outcomes, future need, at many levels, both the state level, the community level, the family, and the individual level. Again, this is really making an attempt to be a little bit less reactive in our policy and really shift to a more proactive policy-making effort. The last piece I would mention is that you know that locally right now there are teams that are working on multiple transformation efforts, and we've been in communication with some of those teams about their need for more real-time data, both in the aggregate and also at the individual consumer level. What this would allow for us to do is provide information to those local teams, primarily in the aggregate. The individual level is this issue we're talking about with the consent form, but be able to really help local teams as they're working on their transformation efforts to have better information upon which to make investments assessments and to make decisions around. So it's about policy alignment and getting better results for Oregonian at bottom, and that's really what this is. Moving on. As you know, we did want to mention that, in the opening slides, I mentioned that there are parts of our budget that involve really the ability for us to self-finance some of the investments that you see here. One of the things that the governor is recommending is that we assume a 3% vacancy savings across all DHS personal services. That achieved a reduction in that what otherwise would have been a current service level roll-up cost for our personal services budget. And as a result of that, it allowed for some investment in other places. It does require us to manage to a lower level operationally in terms of our staffing, which we have done for every biennia that I have been here. We also know that that can have impacts depending on how deep this kind of across the board reduction gets. It can have significant consequences for services, but it was also a way in this budget for us to be able to afford some things that we wanted to be able to do to continue to move the ball forward. So that's a piece of this.
I'd like for you to talk to us a little bit more about this. I'm concerned when I hear that when I hear information about different areas of the agency making do with a caseload of only over 100 families, mm-hmm. or only dozens and dozens of children in foster care, there are some really good ideas that come up in these proposals for let's expand our ability to work in this area and do something new, apply a new way of looking at a problem, and be able to use additional investment directly to families or children or seniors, but to do that will require caseworkers, for example. So I'm concerned when I see those kinds of proposals coupled with, however, to achieve even just leaving things status quo in some cases, we have to endure vacancies, hold positions vacant intentionally. This must put additional stress on the agency generally. I'm having trouble reconciling these two different these two different concepts, which is let's expand this, but let's make everyone else still in the office go through a little extra stress. What can you talk to me about what that's meant in the past when we've had to leave positions vacant for a long time?
Coach Nathanson, I really appreciate the question and the struggle. It's certainly one that weighs heavily on us. As you were talking, I was thinking that you're perfectly describing, I think, the biggest challenge in creating a Department of Human Services budget when the biggest driver is an increased demand for service. And what I think our staff really are seeking is, one, first and foremost, the ability to meet that demand and respond, and two, ultimately decrease the demand. And I think that was the balance that we were trying to strike in this budget. There are certainly some things this budget includes that we have to do that perhaps under different circumstances we would have liked to have done a little bit differently. But I think mostly what you see here is an attempt to be sure that we can meet the need for service, but also the investments that we were targeting, I think, are our hope and our staff's hope that we would actually begin to see a decline in the need for service overall. We know that vacancies and holding positions vacant does put additional pressure on our staff. I would say that thanks to the legislative investments last biennium, staff are feeling better than they have in years about their staffing levels. I know we produced for you all some perspective on where the workload levels hit for each part of the organization. In some places, they're more stressed still than in others. We had a really robust conversation recently at our executive team level about how we would manage something like this, and I think we're very conscientious of where those places are that are more stressed, and we really try and create the opportunity for intentional conversation about where the biggest impacts are of the vacancies, as opposed to just an across-the-board flavor to our conversation. We look within programs at where people are doing work that involves safety, for instance, and where people are doing other kinds of work and who can shoulder this. But this is the give and take of the budget, and I think that at the end of the day, would we like to be able to have both, to have both the adequate staffing fully and also the investments that we think are going to begin to turn the dial? We would, but unfortunately we're just not working in that kind of environment, and so we struck this particular balance, which of course you could undo. And I don't think that either one is wrong. They both have really good justifications and rationales for them. They really do.
Thank you for the response. Helps to hear your thoughts on that.
I think we are nearing the end here. Two more slides. And I'm going to step away for this one just to make sure the experts are giving you this information, and then I'll be back to close it out.
Good morning, Co-Chair Nathanson, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Sarah Miller. I'm the Department of Human Services COO for Information Technology. And I'm here today to talk about a policy option package that is both in the Department of Human Services budget as POP 201 and also in the Oregon Health Authority budget, I think as POP 402, for a program we call REAL Plus D, Race, Ethnicity, and Language Plus Disability. I have with me at the table today my business partners from the Oregon Health Authority and Department of Human Services. I'll ask them to introduce themselves.
Good morning, Representative Nathanson and members of the committee. My name is Lydia Muñiz with the Department of Human Services, the Director of the Office of Equity and Multicultural Services.
Good morning, Co-Chair Nathanson, members of the committee. My name is Carol Cheney, and I serve as the Equity, Policy, and Community Engagement Manager with the Oregon Health Authority Office of Equity and Inclusion.
Committee members, in 2013, you passed House Bill 2134, which required both the Department of Human Services and the Oregon Health Authority to begin to standardize data demographic data collection for a standard set of elements related to the race, ethnicity, preferred spoken and or signed language, preferred written language, and disability status for clients who are serviced by both agencies. You've heard both agency directors and lots of program people for many weeks tell you that a large number of clients are served by both agencies across multiple programs, and we find ourselves in a situation where we don't gather specific consistent information in all of our different IT systems for these data elements. And so you passed the policy bill in 2013 and asked us to go back as two agencies and develop a strategy to implement standardized demographic data collection for these data elements. I'm pleased to report in the role that I provide to the state as the Oregon Health Authority MAGI Medicaid System Transfer Project Director that we're going to leverage some technology from that solution in support of this policy option package, which will take the we are changing the client portal application to gather some additional data elements for the people who are serviced in income-related Medicaid programs. We know that when we gather those data elements, we will be almost a million Oregonians who we will have had standardized information from that can be used as the foundation to start to gather this set of data elements. And so we're still learning, because from the time this original policy option package was written. We've changed strategies to leverage the investment that you and our federal partners are making in the Medicaid solution, but certainly excited about being able to advance the gathering of information that helps my business partners better be able to ensure that Oregonians of diverse background are getting the appropriate health care and access to health care to minimize their health disparities and service from the department in a consistent way to make sure that they're being treated and their disparities of service access are being handled. And so with that, we're open to any questions.
Yes, Representative Brown.
Thank you. Can you tell me what is different about and what you're going to be doing that's different? And is this just a check a box on a form?
Co-Chair Nathanson, Representative Boone. So a few things. When the law was passed, my business partners worked on an administrative rule for both agencies that creates a standard set of values that all programs need to ask for certain of these data elements. And so what the Medicaid project will do is take that standard set of values and gather it for every Oregonian who will access MAGI Medicaid programs. And then we'll make that information available through reporting to the folks who report federally and set strategies across programs for how to better serve people with disparities. So for example, for people who get Medicaid benefit, we'll actually transmit their preferred answers to coordinated care organizations to make sure that when CCOs are servicing those individuals, they understand what their preferred language is, we understand how to provide them care in a culturally appropriate way as a basis of that language, and then the CCOs can report about the service they provide to those individuals as part of the business outcomes that are required for our health disparity experience.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, Erin Kelly Seal, back on the record. I do want to just add one thing to my answer to the question Representative Nathanson asked about vacancies, and I want to mention partners because there is some other shared sacrifice in this budget that I think is worth mentioning that doesn't have a slide because it didn't necessarily require a policy package. But when our first of all, those vacancy savings we do apply to our shared delivery partners. And so that is a piece of the conversation that I think is worth mentioning. But also I want to mention that the other piece that the other reduction effort that happened within the budget that I know you're hearing about is this issue around rates and cost of living increases for providers. And I think I mentioned at the beginning that for our provider community, this budget does not include much in the way of rate increases or cost of living. In fact, there are, at least by my count, only three in the budget. And so some of the things that we've been talking about in terms of cost to do business, for us, this is about the agency is giving up some things, and I know that our provider community is giving up some things in order to yield additional service options and additional capacity for the service options that we provide. So just to close it out, I think even though there are, we've spent the last couple of days talking about things that are new, most of those things line up with, all of them line up with these themes that we've been talking with you about throughout our budget presentations. You all kicked off some pretty significant initiatives in our agency last biennium that we need to complete. There are federal changes. There were quite a few this last biennium that impacted our organization that are reflected in this budget. Obviously, we've been talking a lot about outcomes and prioritizing and efforts to create more upstream investment, a conscious focus on long-term financial sustainability in particular budgets, and then also the ability to leverage partnerships in behalf of better services for Oregonians.
Ms. Ellisdale, you've done a really good job of pulling together big themes and big needs into a package of proposals for us to consider. I appreciate all the information that you've been bringing to us the past few days.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Are there any follow-up comments or questions? We'll be seeing you here again. Thank you.
Ms. Byerly. Madam Co-Chair, there is no subcommittee meeting tomorrow. However, Oregon Health Authority will be in on Wednesday to do the same thing that DHS did for the last couple of days.
Okay. That's all for today. We're adjourned.
All of it too, right?
Wow.
Okay. Thanks.
Is that because yours is lacking again, Lori? I'm kidding.
Yes.
Is that because yours is lacking again, Lori? I'm kidding.